Welcome to season 4 of Conscious Conversations. This season is titled The Educational Experience as Self-Knowledge. We explore learning not merely as instruction, but as a sacred embodied practice, a way of becoming, transforming, and returning to ourselves. I am your host, Mabato Monze, a spiritual practitioner, independent transdisciplinary researcher, and spherical guide. My work is rooted in Africana womanist ecometaphysics and grounded in indigenous knowledge systems. This podcast is an offering, a living archive of memory and possibility. Together with teachers, artists, visionaries, and cultural workers, we enter conversation as ritual, as recovery, and as reimagining. Welcome. Thank you so much, Dr. Scott, for making the time to join us in this conversation. That is titled, this season of Conscious Conversations is titled The Educational Experience as Self-Knowledge. And, you know, one of the reasons that made me that led me to framing this season in this way is because I realized the more I get into academic literature, the more I realize that a lot of what we're experiencing now is not new, you know, and there's a lot of academic literature out there. So if there's all this literature, all this education, I guess, and the world continues to go from bad to worse, I'm not like trying to be negative or cynical, but looking at South Africa's levels of inequality as an example, you know, it does not seem like things are getting better, and yet there's all this progress. And so I was inspired to explore education as a radical site of remembering, where learning becomes a spiritual, political, and embodied practice or experience. We consider how education can move us toward wholeness and ethical presence, not through assimilation, but through deep listening, critical unlearning, and meaningful action. As I mentioned, you know, the scientific knowledge is out there, but there's something that is fundamentally lacking. And so I invited you to join us in this conversation titled The Educated Self as Action-Oriented Praxis. This conversation will explore social justice, education, personal awakening, and learning, domination, and reclaiming voice, with attention to how education can become a vehicle for transformation and collective responsibility, which is also tied to my own journey of remembering what it means to be a person or a human being in the African context, right? So welcome.
Thank you, Mabako. Thank you so much for inviting me to be in this conversation, ongoing conversation, because you and I have spoken a bit about this. And it's an honor to be here and talk about these things. All in 1 hour, we're going to take care of everything. All right. It'll be a continuation, right? So, yes, I mean, there's a lot of that. As someone who was in school for a long time, you know, and still, I'm still a lifelong learner. It's just, I agree with you that I think we're going to have to do something different that we haven't been doing. And not just like digesting information and then reverberating that information, but it's about how are things landing and how are they staying rooted in us? And then also, what is our relationship to this information? What is our relationship to these, to this research, to this critical thinking? And then how are we allowing space to be transformed and to transform others, right, in this way? But I think I shared this with you, but I just recently was facilitating these conversations and engagement around beloved community, which was Dr. King's practice and vision before he was assassinated. And so, you know, I put on about three workshops in community engaged workshops, where one of them was a group of teenagers, which were amazing. And then the other two were a group of adults. And, you know, we a lot of the work that we did, it was a 4-hour workshop. We did a lot of play, a lot of creativity, some envisioning and a lot of embodying of what beloved community, not just this kind of Webster's definition of beloved community, but how does it show up in everyday interactions, conversations within our systems. And so some of the feedback that I got from both the young people and from the elders and adults in these spaces was that folks told me that they had not really been social since COVID. You know, they really haven't been out and engaging in community, and that this was just kind of this amazing experience, not just because, oh, I'm such a great facilitator, right? But it's more around like we invited community to come together and actually engage in a conversation or in some interaction that wasn't just didactic or, you know, linear, but it was actually around narrative and storytelling and identity and around issues of gender and race and, you know, physical ability, mental ability. You know, our young people were on this, some of them were on the spectrum, you know, in this conversation as well. So some of the things that I keep being reminded of is that we need practice. We need practice how to be human. We need practice how to be more human. You know, Grace Boggs used to say we need to be more human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, creativity and play, especially with adults, gets left out in practice. We don't think we need to practice as adults, and especially as academics. You know, we don't think we have to, once we have our EDDs or PhDs or whatever it is that we gain from the academy, we don't think we need practice anymore. Mm-hmm. And that kind of lack of humility is more of the end than any kind of continuation or beginning.
But it also speaks to how education has also been, and maybe it might be that it has always been the case, where it's very classist, you know, because I look here in South Africa, when people have their postgraduate degrees or when, you know, they have this upward social mobility, then it almost like it creates a disconnect between them and the communities where they grew up. And I suppose, you know, we can argue that it is natural. People change your interests, you meet new people, etc., etc. But I find that it is not many people who go back to, you know, give back to their communities. And maybe it also has a lot to do with the red race of becoming middle class, you know, how it almost like locks you in to a particular mindset where you also become so entrapped into sustaining a particular life. You know, I always say to people that, you know, this thing of becoming middle class, it's like they dangle a little carrot stick in front of your eyes, but you never really get there. You know, you look at people who continue to work, you think by 65, people have paid up their bonds. Many people have not. Many people cannot really retire in peace, like many Black people cannot really retire well. And so For me, those are just some of my initial reflections. But who is John Scott and why is social justice important to you? What is your journey?
Well, thank you for that, for those questions. And then also, I will say, yes, that classism, that classism and that conditioning that you're talking about, that we get pre-verbal. We're seeing messages as little babies. So we're seeing, we're picking up on all those messages about what it means to be valued, literally valued, in dollars and cents. And not as a human being, as a human, you know, spirit. And so I think that is really that deconditioning and that unpacking of that is really important. And unless that is built into our educational practices, we have to assume that we're all conditioned with the same stuff, you know, that is not true. And when I think of black people and black body human beings, you know, who have been lied to about who they are. And then also this kind of like the carrot you talked about, the dangling of the carrot, that we thought, well, once we get that, we're going to be okay. And then we realize we weren't, right? And we're not. Even though we've got a few billionaires running around, you know, it's still this thing where most of us are still struggling. So I just wanted to name that. And then your question was, who am I and what am I, what am I doing? And the how do I see social justice? Can you say again, how do I see social justice? Is why do I think social justice is important? You know, I think for me, you know, I'm one of eight children, right? Growing up in Los Angeles from two parents who migrated from the South, who left the South and left Louisiana because of Jim Crow and economic injustice and lynchings and everything else. It was basically a kiss of death to be there, you know? And so they left and came to Los Angeles and had eight of us, hoping for something, talk about the carrot, hoping for something different and hoping for something to shift, which I think things did shift. But I also found, you know, I think this is something, and maybe this might not answer the question you're asking, but I was thinking about how our families get it wrong many times where they, you know, we had eight children, right? And so the way that my parents identified who was brilliant and smart and who wasn't, it wasn't right, you know? And so I think there was a lot of competition within our own family or within our siblings, even with our parents. And I think, you know, my parents, they were both brilliant, you know, very smart people, right? My dad got his MBA when he had like six children, you know, in the house. And, you know, they were not like wealthy people, right? It was very, money was tight. But I think as far as, you know, I think they got it wrong as far as who was, you know, and there's some great articles about this and there's some research around this, how families get it wrong a lot. And they put this pressure on certain kids to kind of be the light of the family, right? Who's going to be the doctor? Who's going to be the lawyer, right? And then that's that narcissistic extension, right, of themselves. And so I grew up just from a personal, you know, my personal stories, I grew up thinking I was stupid. I really thought I was dumb. And I was told, I wasn't told that, but non-verbally, I think my parents kind of just gave up because I learned very differently. And I was also a very feeling, sensitized human being. And so I picked up on everything and it just completely overwhelmed me. And so I was exhausted most of the time. You know, I go to school, Catholic, you know, nuns and very strict. And I just couldn't focus because I wouldn't get to sleep at night till probably, you know, 3-4 in the morning because I was so stressed out. And then I would have to wake up at 7, right? And then every day was just I would go to school and I couldn't focus. I wanted to focus, but I couldn't focus. And so, you know, that was that kept spinning and I kept, well, you know, that self kind of perpetuating, you know, kind of a reality that happened was I believed that I wasn't smart. And I was told non-verbally that I wasn't smart. There was a lot of concern. What's wrong with Java, right? And so it took me years. I'm going to fast forward the story, but it took me years to come back to myself in my 30s and decide to go back to school because I wanted not to you know, make $1 million, right? I mean, I wanted to work, but mostly I wanted to heal some of that and heal some of that within myself, but also be able to serve communities in a way that was meaningful, work with young people, work in communities that were also struggling with some of these same lies about themselves, whether it was around race, whether it was around gender, sexual orientation, ability. So that to me is social justice for me is healing. It represents healing for me because there's been a great injury that's been caused by our systems, including our own families that internalized a lot of these lies. I always called them internal lies, L-I-E-S, right? We internalize those lies about ourselves and our communities. And then I went back to school and, you know, I didn't stop. And so here I am at a PhD level, you know, doing the work, but I'm still healing. It's not like I haven't arrived anywhere. It's continuing. But for me, that's the, when I think about social justice, again, you can walk into a room where there's 30 people, ask them what social justice means and get 30 different, you know, definitions. But for me, I think social justice has meant being in community, being in relationship with myself, with the planet, with my environment, with spirituality. It's not just one thing. It's with other human beings that are struggling within a system that's lied to them for generations. And it's about truth-telling in a way that lifts us up.
What you share has got so much wisdom in it because, you know, so firstly, you spoke about being a sensitive child, right? And of which, I mean, I've always been very sensitive. And as one grows up, you kind of like get conditioned into believing that there's something wrong with you because you feel so much, right? And so that disconnect from yourself begins to happen, right? And so for me, the journey has also really been beautiful in discovering, oh no, there was nothing wrong with me, you know, and being right. able to find it also through literature, you know, right. As you know, you know, you've read some of my work, like looking at literature, and working with literature to find language for things I've always felt, for things I've always known, and realizing that actually I'd rather be like Bell Hooks. I'd rather be like Ellis Walker. I'd rather be like Martin Luther King. You know, I'd rather be like all these other people than what the dominant culture is teaching me that is more valuable because it comes at such a great cost. And usually the cost would be not being truthful to yourself in order to assimilate or to belong to a particular culture, right? And now you speak about healing, which has also been a very integral part of my own journey, where because I'm doing the healing, and for me, that this sense of awareness and activism has always been with me, even when I didn't have the language to articulate it. But now being more inspired, you know, to do this social justice work and this healing work, and to also see how it is connected to ancestral healing work. So that intergenerational healing of you know, healing from the internalized oppression we inherited through our families, you know, first of all, about who we are and which parts of us are valid and acceptable and which parts are not, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, that extends to the broader system because the system then has created this reality that says if you do not have X, Y, and Z, you are not worthy. You know, so how do we begin to think about these themes as they relate to education and not the institution of education? Because that, again, is underpinned by capitalism and all sorts of isms.
Yeah. Right. It's like the system of education versus the system of learning, right? And I don't think they should be separate. I think there should be, but I think there's been a disembodiment of our systems and disembodiment of our as human beings from feeling and from being in relationship with these concepts that we're learning or what we're reading. And I really appreciated what you shared about you know, literature and reading. You know, I remember when you were saying this, I had these memories of reading James Baldwin for the first time. You know, we have these books all over our house, but I just never focused. I was never able to focus on anything because I was so, you know, fight or flight and kind of in this kind of traumatized space. But once I actually sat down and started reading, I thought, that's exactly what I've been thinking. That's what I've been thinking about myself, this internal, you know, through the characters that he created, or Alice Walker and Temple of My Familiar and some of the books that I read. I started realizing there's a place for me in critical thinking. There's a place for me in thinking about these things. So the thing that I think, you know, saddens me is that there's so many folks in our communities that don't get to have that experience because they're in that similar space of just having to survive, and having to make do in a system that really doesn't acknowledge their existence or their value. And so then part of that social justice for me is creating spaces for folks to slow down a little bit enough to breathe, to collect themselves and to learn about who they are so they can be more of who they were meant to be. And I think also what our ancestors, you know, I believe what our ancestors want is for us to be better. You know, they want us to break the patterns they could not break. And whether it's because of systems that are oppressive or racist or sexist, you know, systems that came in at them, or their own struggles with addiction and issues of problematic thinking, you know, all these kind of things. I think they want us to heal that. And I think, you know, one of the things, I shared this a little bit, but I do think that something that's really hard, when I think of, you know, of course, I identify as a Black, you know, human being with parents from the South, right? So when I think about what's harmed us as a people has been this one-dimensionalizing of who we are. It's like this one-dimensional, you know, I remember when I was doing, and I know that you love Dr. King and some of his work and or a lot of his work, body of work, but I remember doing research, you know, for this performance. I was doing a one-person show on the civil rights movement, you know, for 5 years that went into schools that talked about the civil rights movement from 1955 to 1965 when the Voter Rights Act was passed. And so in order to do this performance, I just wanted to do a ton of research. And I was looking through old films with Dr. King and Malcolm X and Ella Baker and Diane Nash and all these amazing people that I was just beginning to learn about, because in school, I mean, we may have been taught about Dr. King, but not really. It was not in depth. It was just like, I have a dream, right? And so I remember one of the videos I saw of him, his house had just been bombed, right? His house had been blown to pieces. His family somehow, I don't know, I don't think they were there, so they managed to escape, but and you could see he was in a suit as he always was. They said, are you scared? Are you scared about what just happened? And I saw him do this thing with his face. He looked down for a second and he collected himself and he said, no, I'm not scared. He said, you know, because the movement has to happen, the civil right, you know, we're fighting for rights. And it just hit me. I just started sobbing. And I thought, because he didn't get a chance to be scared and to worry about his family and his wife and his children that could have been murdered. He had to talk about the movement. within a few seconds of him finding out what happened, he had to do something in his brain that took maybe a few, this is his brilliance, a few seconds, and he went there. But I saw it because I've felt that before, and I've had to do this kind of about face, you know, kind of thing. And so I think there's something about that that is both beautiful and also really disturbing, how we have had to just be this one-dimensionalized leader, or this one-dimensionalized, I'm a writer, or I'm just a musician. And this is why I have, you know, I think I should share this with you, but I have these pictures behind me. And this is like, you know, Nina Simone, she's on a bicycle. And Dr. King's on a bicycle. And then Dexter Gordon, because we get to play, we get to have a life, we get to be fully formed human beings. And I think there's a violence that happens when that's taken away from us. You know, when we're minimized to this place where we just, you know, we can't be fully human.
And I feel like the system is doing what it's doing, particularly in its racist form. I mean, it's the only reason really they're doing what they're doing is because of who we are, you know, as spiritual beings. And I often feel like if Black people, especially, I know Indigenous people all over the world have been affected by colonization and patriarchy. But I mean, I'm experiencing my life in a body of a Black woman, you know? And so the idea of being a creator, you know, the idea of being half human, half divine, as our ancestors have always known, that gets scary sometimes. But I think it is so important that we remember who we are at that deep level. And it speaks to that multidimensionality of our identity as beings, right? And our ability to be resilient and to imagine different futures, which I feel like education in its institutionalized form has not been able to do that. And you know, I'm writing about Christianity as it relates to Africa and our African traditions and customs and cosmology, because we, before colonization, we had a different understanding of reality and the all that is a part of reality. And so feeling like if African people remembered that about who they are, like how we understand literature and theory would be so different, because we would not only understand it from an intellectual perspective, but because we'd be tapped into spirit as well, it would be able to arouse our imaginations as creators so that we can imagine and build a different world. And that starts with community for me. You know, can we imagine communities of care, you know, of mutual learning and interdependence, of creating different systems, right? A lot of social injustices have happened around economies as well, you know, which is a big challenge for communities that have been marginalized by the dominant system, where because we are busy trying to survive, we are also not able to build these alternative communities that are also able to support, you know, our projects economically and so on. So it is really a self-perpetuating system, right? But I feel like something has got to give, you know, at some point. I mean, I often, with great frustration, I think about people like Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King. And, you know, I get so sad that he died. He died because he believed it was possible. He believed, and along with many other, you know, women like, you know, you look at Rosa Parks and her courage to stand up and say, actually, no.
Right.
You know, as opposed to looking at what is it going to cost me?
Yes. Yes.
You know, so how do we begin to think about those things in the practical sense? And I know we don't have the answers, right? But yeah, it just feels like a double-edged sword. But I also know that at some point, one needs to make a decision to say, it ends with me.
Yes, yes. Thank you for this. Yes, that's, I mean, you said this in the beginning of our conversation, but it's remembering is part of that, right? Remembering, bringing the pieces back together is such an important piece of this, not only healing, but just us to continue to learn holistically and not just partially or one-dimensionally. And so remembering these stories, I don't mean just remembering them for the sake of remembering them, right? I know a lot of people who call themselves historians that are disconnected from the history they've memorized, mm-hmm. right? They're not in relationship. They don't feel anything. They don't really have a connection to the people who have gone and passed. I still feel, you know, as you, I feel those ancestors with me. They still talk to me. So they're not gone to me. Physically, they're gone. But I, you know, part of remembering for me is to understand that for me, that's been my reality since I was a child, that I'm always feeling and hearing and dreaming and having these relationships with folks who are no longer on this physical, on this physical plane. And then, you know, one of the things you were talking about was, you know, you said, you know, you're 50%, you know, divine and 50% woman. But I just wonder what would it mean to think about being 100% divine and 100% woman, right? 100% of all these things. Because I think we've been taught and conditioned to fraction or fragment. And I just believe we're whole. And I think part of the damage is we were told we're not. And so we've been lied to about having to split parts of our own identities because of these laws and legislation, the one drop law that they had in the South, where if you have one drop of black blood, then you were considered black. You know, we have everything is, we have German, we have French, we have, you know, we have African, we have indigenous blood, and all that is 100% who I am, right? And I have to reconcile with those parts of who I am. And so I think it's important. I'm just thinking about that too, around how I've been lied to around being portioned out. And I don't mean just with identity, but just in general. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking about, this is also some of the, you know, it's part of the research that I was doing around civil rights work. And part of that research was remembering and being in relationship with that memory. And Diane Nash, you know, she was the one of the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, just a brilliant black woman who was doing work. And she was talking about, and this was another moment that I had, you know, watching this interview, but she talked about when the four little girls died in that bombing in Alabama, four little girls were murdered. And she said, you know, we were all just, you know, devastated that these little girls were killed. And we thought maybe this nonviolent tactic or strategy is not working anymore. Maybe we need to do something different. You know, they were really, even Dr. King was questioning. He felt like he wasn't protecting his kids in the community, right? And she said, we knew who did it. We knew who killed these girls. They were bragging about it. The folks who bombed the church were going around telling people that they did it. She said, we knew where they lived.
We knew where they worked. We knew who they were. And so we had two choices, she said. Choice number one was we could find them and we could kill them for what they did to our children. She said that was choice number one. This is the student nonviolent coordinating committee, right? She said we could find them and we could take them out. Choice number two was we secure the vote for everybody. We secure the vote for Black people, and then we can actually vote these people out of power for several generations ahead, and we could actually change our systems in a way that are more equitable and transform things. She said we chose choice number two. And to me, that just, I mean, when I think about, again, the grief of losing four children and the courage it takes to stay with a strategy that meant that these humans that caused this harm would walk away free. But they were thinking several generations ahead, which is a very indigenous, practice, which is thinking not just for me and for what I need, but what are my future ancestors, my future, relatives going to have to deal with. And so I think that courage but I think that the difference between someone, to kind of knowing that history and memorizing that history is very different. Like if somebody memorized that, they wouldn't understand the relationship to why that's so important. And I'm grateful that I feel it, but not everybody does. I know professors, as we speak, will assign books like Bell Hooks, Patricia Hill Collins, they'll assign these texts, and then they don't know how to facilitate a conversation around issues of critical pedagogy and race. And they also may be bigots. These are professors that could be bigots. These are professors that actually are racist and sexist and homophobic, but actually will have a curriculum that they've designed and they're getting paid monthly for their work. And I've seen this in organizations and systems that I've worked in that folks don't really have a relationship or an investment or really even value. They talk a good talk, but they don't really do the work. And that has to shift. And so when I think of social justice, I think of that as well. Social justice means, we find our relationship, to what's happened before, so we don't make the same mistakes. So we don't cause unnecessary harm.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And, I'm thinking about how we also make those choices, to say whether we are going to choose the violent or the nonviolent way, and what some of these have freedoms often represent for the Earth's most marginalized human beings, which has always been Black women, right? And so, in cases where, according to history, the freedoms have it, it was white men at the top, white women, Black men, and then Black women. So Black women have always been at the bottom of the list. And so when Black men got their freedom or certain rights, they could oppress Black women in specific ways, right? And you look at Black women in relation to the feminist movement, where white women could never understand the challenges of or the oppressions of Black women, right? So when we think about justice and what becomes a strategy, who wins, who loses, just in terms of politics and what is happening right now. Cyril Ramaphosa and his delegation were in the United States. They probably still are. And one of the big, I think, agenda items was the fact that Elon Musk wants to have his Starlink in South Africa, and he could not do it without following a BEE, with Black Empowerment, policy, which I think it states that he needs to have at least 30% of Black local ownership, you know, as part of the deal. Otherwise, he can't have Starlink here. And it seems, according to reports, that the South African government has adjusted this BEE policy because of this meeting and the fact that, you know, white genocide, which is very false, is being used against South Africa. And so you look at what democracy in this particular instance, where Starlink coming to South Africa, yes, for billionaires and, you know, people who are going to benefit from those deals, it works. But you look at the broader politics of South Africa and Africa, it means that the poor will continue to be marginalized, right? Because it means that if this BEE deal comes, it means that other policies in relation to this entire political debacle are also going to be compromised. So again, poor people are the ones losing out, just like historically in terms of certain freedoms or certain rights. Yes, Black men have benefited. Maybe white women have benefited. They've always benefited anyways. But Black women continued to be subjugated by, you know, certain forms of domination from both, or at least from a gender perspective, from a race perspective, from a class perspective. So how do we begin to think about justice in that multidimensional or intersectional way?
With deep gratitude to Mtutu Ndebele, his Indumba EP not only invites ancestral presence, but it also awakens the spirit.
Yeah, I mean, it's a it's a really it's a great question. It's a painful question that we have to ask, because this is where we are. I just appreciate you naming those pieces around Black women and I think one of the ways is it's beyond. I think I was just reading an article that said beyond acknowledgement, because you know, just to say, listen, I acknowledge that that's an issue. Like as a Black male, to say I acknowledge that Black women have been targeted and oppressed and still are, that's not enough. You know, I don't get a trophy because I agree, right? Like, what is the breadth and depth of the work that I still need to continue to do and undo to really heal and to understand my relationship, you know, to Black, not just Black women, but what has been done and what continues to be done, and how to interrupt those out of control systems that actually, even when we use the word benefit, right? It's like, you know, am I really benefiting if my sister is struggling and my mother is struggling? You know, I was raised by a Black woman and a Black man who said, basically, who both would say, remember that you're part of this family, and anything you do will impact us, and anything I do will impact you, right? So that's kind of the, even if things weren't perfect growing up, that's something that's always been, I can't pretend that I'm benefiting from anything if it's harming someone that I care about and love, right? And so really it's to acknowledge that we're lying to ourselves about, you know, getting a few dollars or living on this side of the hill or whatever it is we are convincing ourselves of is privilege, because folks are miserable. Let's be clear. They're not, I'm not saying that they're not privileging from, you know, the money and whatever, you know, education and all these kind of things, but it is killing us. It's killing us energetically. It's killing us spiritually, and it's killing us physically. I mean, it really has, that has a toll, speaking about our bodies being impacted. So I think it's really just, when I think about these kind of issues, I mean, I think about addiction and pathology. You know, I think about, because this is part of my mental health, you know, my graduate work was in, and master's work was in mental health. And I can't separate, you know, you can't just passively deal with addiction. you have to really, if you're someone who drinks, you have to stop drinking. There's no other way around. I used to have a friend, you know, he passed away, who was an alcoholic. He said, John, I can't just have one drink. If I have one drink, it's over. And he's right. He caused so much damage to himself and to his community, to his family. And so we have to understand who's benefiting. And I'm sure when he was doing this craziness, when living like a crazy person, he felt like he was getting something. He felt happy. He was drunk. He was, you know, whatever it was he was doing, sleeping around, all these things that he felt like he was getting something was literally killing him and killing his family and his community. So I think we have to stop the lies, and we have to acknowledge that this is pathological, that we have dehumanized systemically and interpersonally Black women. And that is not, you know, it's beyond not being okay. It's killing us. And so, and it's also, you know, the potential for brilliance, you know, with our Black women is just, it's everywhere. I mean, it's, and so why are we denying that? Why are we, you know, that it makes no sense, no rational sense to create systems that push Black women out, mm-hmm. right? And so that's where we're at. It's like we have to acknowledge that it's a pathology, and it's actually sick, and it's poison.
Yeah, these things are complex, you know, because, and I think it might be the case in the U.S. as well. Black women are getting executive roles and leadership, but I feel because that feminine, you know, the divine and grounded feminine has been suppressed. And it speaks to our own personal being experiences of being othered. They had a lot to do with our sensitivities, right? Which are often ascribed to the feminine energy, you know, and that for me, and as I'm learning, as I'm reading, that is connected to the feminine energy, right? And so right. Earlier when I was referring to the divinity and the humanness, for me it also speaks to our understanding our fallible nature. You know, in my reading of Dr. King's work, you know, they say, he was a very self-critical person. And I connected to my understanding of Boto, otherwise known as Ubuntu, where one is continuously striving towards becoming a better human being. You know, and that requires quite a bit of reflection, right? And so in being a well-rounded, integrated human being, who comprises of the masculine and the feminine energy, that would ideally be working in unison or in dynamic harmony. Our, yes, women in terms of becoming executives, in terms of a particular kind of leadership role, are getting there. But I feel like the groundedness that is often attributed to especially the creativity of Black women is losing, like it has been lost, you know, that essence of what it means to create a community, what it means to, I know my mother used to, she was very resourceful and she could stretch her rent and sense, you know? So I feel like to a certain degree, because certain things have been normalized, we have also lost our creativity around creating or imagining otherwise, you know? So because a part of us as human beings has been dominated and silenced, we are also not able to tap into the creative ways in which we could be together in building communities and in being more resourceful. Someone I know, she's a pastor, Diane Ford. I had her in our previous Conscious Conversations. You know, she made an example. So she doesn't really like the internet, but she made an example of how back then, you know, African people who were slaves knew how to mobilize without technology. They knew how to spread the word. They knew how to say to other slaves, don't go through that route, use that one. They had plans, whether it was cuts of fabric, whether it was letters, whether other forms of communication, but they knew how to mobilize. They knew how to get things going. So why are we not able to do that?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you said so much that is resonating with me today. But one of the things I think this you really, I think, are tapping into some truth around, you know, the piece that our genders, our sexuality, our race, you know, all the color of our skin, all of that's been so politicized. And like, you know, we're born into this world, right? We're these babies, and then all these things start coming in at us, right? As far as like race, gender, sexual orientation, ability. And so I think what happens is I shared the story of myself, you know, growing up and internalizing. I started internalizing, yeah, well, if they're giving up on me, I'm going to give up on me, right? That was kind of the, as a child, seemed reasonable to just believe what they were telling me about me, because they were the adults and they were the ones that supposedly know everything, right? And so when I think we were talking about Black women getting these executive roles, you know, I've been in organizations where, whether it's Black men or women or, you know, LGBTQ folks that finally get these positions of leadership, and it's a bit of a shit show. I mean, it really is. It's a mess because they've been so conditioned. And so at that point, by the time they get there, through their education, through their all the conditioning that they've gone through and all the lies they've been told about their own self, it's been ugly. I've seen some really horrible, painful. I've had some painful experiences. And I think it's because our systems are still our systems, right? They're still doing what they do, which are all mostly steeped in this capitalistic, you know, this capitalistic paradigm where the only thing that's valued is dollars and cents. And so that's a big, I think that when I think about what work needs to be done and the work that we don't talk about, but it's the first thing that gets in the way, is all that internalized stuff around issues of sexism, racism, homophobia, all these things that we swallow and then just we vomit up when we're in these and project, right? Projectile onto everybody when we are in these community settings. We have to do that work. And I think because our systems have done so much damage, you would think our systems, as far as reparations, would actually make space to deal with these things. But the only thing they make space for is these kind of multicultural, like, let's all get together as a staff and talk about, no. How about we talk about internalized racism? How about we talk about internalized sexism, and people can be in these kind of caucus spaces? A lot of systems aren't supporting that kind of work. But a lot of us same systems have caused the damage. So there should be a certain responsibility and accountability. At least we can take that accountability and do that work. I'm assuming, since I've been a Black-bodied person in this on this planet for, you know, 61 years, I've been targeted, right, in lots of ways, and I've internalized some BS about myself. I know that, and so unless, again, I can't be passive about that work. I have to. When you talk about
Dr. King critically. I mean, I really, that's built into my, I have to do that work, and I apply pressure. I train myself to apply pressure to those places that I need some attention. And sometimes the way I find out about that is through a very negative interaction, right? Or it's, you know, taking on a role that I wasn't ready for or something, and all of a sudden something gets triggered and I'm like, oh, I gotta go back and look at this. I gotta look at what this is. You know, but I love what you also said about, you know, enslaved Africans, you know, found a way to communicate without an iPhone, you know, without, you know, they were, you know, there's a great, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but there's a great documentary film called Rooted Wisdom. And Rooted Wisdom is, nature's role in the Underground Railroad. And it talks about how enslaved Africans read the stars. They read the stars and they were able to communicate in all these different ways. And if they didn't understand the earth, if they didn't understand the trees and the signals, they would never have been able to leave and find their way to freedom. And so it was the first film that I've seen that talks about our relationship as enslaved Africans who were basically going towards freedom. It talked about our relationship with the natural world. And it seems like there should be so many stories about that, but, or, you know, documented. I think it's documented, but in some different ways, in slave narratives and enslaved people's narratives. But I do think that we have to tap back into that. And I know that you know this. I know that this is some of the work you're doing about how do we, I guess I want to ask you, like, how do we find our way back?
Your prelude to the question is so rich, because I feel like focusing on our strengths, you know, is so important. You know, in my work, I also try to understand the mind, you know, and you can also apply it to the laws of the universe, right? Whatever you focus on expands, right? So yes, in us doing or recognizing what we have gone through as Black people and Indigenous people of the world, we also need to remember our brilliance. You know, the things we were good at. I always say in my work in understanding ancestral trauma, it's also important that I understand the wisdom I'm inheriting from, or I've inherited from my ancestors, and to connect more deeply into that. You know, I was saying to someone that in as far as African politics are concerned, I do not believe we can fight and win a war on other people's terms. You just can't fight from a deficit. You know, you just can't get into even football. You know, I'm not as much a sports fanatic, but you once your opponent sets the tone for you and you follow, you play on their terms, then you're gone. You know, so I think the work is in remembering who we are and enacting that every day. And that speaks to, you know, the educational practice itself. You know, so as we begin to know ourselves, what does ethical relationality mean? What does being in beloved community mean? You know, what does it mean to show up with care? Authenticity, but with care. You know, but I feel like these are things we need to aspire towards, so that we can consistently be reflecting. You know, it's also, I think, an academic term, reflexivity, where you are continuously checking in. From which point am I behaving like that? Why did I respond in that way? You know, was it just a knee-jerk reaction, or, you know, as I actually present in that particular situation? So it's the work that is required. And unfortunately, it is easy to not do it. It is easy to be a zombie to be checked out. Yes. You know, it's easy because it does not require you to change.
Ever any kind of discomfort, right? We have to. It feels counterintuitive, but we have to step into the discomfort. We have to actually. It's kind of like, to me, sometimes exercise for me, it hurts sometimes, but it's, I feel so good, you know, I feel so good after, because it's something that I know it's good for me. And it's, you know, there's a, you know, I think I shared with you, I do theater of the oppressed, exercises. And one of the exercises that Augusta Boal, you know, created, which I love this exercise, but you know, you basically, it's called pushing without winning. And you face the person and you push as hard as you can. You're not just leaning into each other, but you're just really pushing as hard as you can. But you're not. But as soon as you feel yourself winning, you kind of back off, but you keep the tension going. So you should be kind of sweating after a while, and you're just pushing and pushing. And people are really just, it's a fun exercise. But he says, you know, basically, if his theory is, if I throw you on the ground. If I push you on the ground, I lose and you lose, mm-hmm. because there's no more tension, mm-hmm. and there's no more conversation. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to keep the creative tension, to keep the conversation, to keep the dialogue, to be uncomfortable, mm-hmm. to actually, you know, it requires some effort, right? We're not just leaning in and then getting comfortable. We're actually really exploring the boundaries on some level. And that's just one exercise, right? How do we play in a way that teaches us how to be in community, and not just I can lie to myself. I mean, I'm a pretty smart person, so I can convince myself of just about anything, right? And so that's not so great. I want to be able to be challenged. I want to be able to be in the moment and respond honestly. I think we've forgotten how to do that. There's a lot of performing. There's a lot of influencing going on. But as far as authenticity, I think we need to get back to, what do we feel in this moment right now? And be really honest about that. And this could be around identity. This could be around, you know, gender. But where is the tension? Tension's not bad. It's something to pay attention to.
Yeah, attention is not bad. It's something to pay attention to. Yeah, I was thinking earlier this week, I cannot imagine myself having done the same thing for 20 years. Like, you know, and there are people who are just so comfortable with just things being the same.
Yes. You know, I know we're getting to our time, but I was just thinking about this. I was just saying this the other day, how I'm so grateful. I went to this event with the city of Lakewood here in Washington, and they wanted me to present an update of the Beloved Community, you know, work that I was doing, and I was excited to do this. And I asked one of my young people if they were interested in coming and presenting, and she came, and, you know, I was really moved by what she said. You know, young black woman who just got into a college, you know, she's really smart, and she spoke to them about hearing her speak about the engagement, the 4-hour engagement we had was such a gift to hear it, because I said this out loud later, you know, but I said, I just never thought when I'd be in my 60s that young people would still like me. Like they would still want to be in this play space with me and also really get something out of that space. It's such, for me, it's less of an ego and a much, much more of a gift. Like, if I still have that gift to be able to do that, I want to keep engaging. But, you know, she talked about it wasn't just this linear training that we have in school. Sometimes we got to explore and think about things. We got to examine words. I mean, she really went into depth with her experience. And I was so just, I was just so grateful that I'm lucky enough to be able to work with elders, with young people in all these different ways. And there's something about that, like you said, I don't want to be doing the same thing
I'm doing similar things, but I'm working in communities still that I just never thought I'd still be working with. And that to me is such a gift. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to feel, I mean, I don't want to, I want to continue to feel relevant. You know, I want the work, I want to be relevant. And so I have to keep pushing myself. And I think with the young people, because young people are smart, they will, they have a good radar. I call it the bullshit radar. They'll be like, And all 14 of these young people were just so engaged. And I was just like, it's such a gift that they trust me and I trust them and I'm doing my work and they can see it. And, you know, it's just, you can't pretend, especially in a lot of our communities, we have that radar. We know when people are not for real. And so it's really, for me, it's a responsibility to keep doing my work. Even if I never tell them that I was in therapy or I was in these groups, they know, we know. I know, you know, engaging with you, I know the work. I know that you're doing your work.
You know, you're bringing in a very important component to the conversation, which is that intergenerational knowledge transfer or experiences, right? But also the healing, considering the fact that for many of us in the Black community, especially people who come from marginalized communities, right, our families are so broken, you know. And so young people who are not wanting to enact the same patterns that are often so not regenerative, you know, from our communities or from our families, our lineages. We need the beloved community. So can you share a little bit about the work you do, you know, in relationship, especially to that intergenerational healing, you know, and the healing that you also get in nurturing and mentoring young people? Because a lot of the time, I think, at least how I've experienced older people, and it's not how I've experienced you. Like, I know in our first encounters, I said to you, I love being in community with you because, you know, I feel like you're being yourself. You know, it's not like you are trying to, it's not hierarchical. You know, you are not undermining my experiences. And you are also open to sharing your own experiences, even, you know, the hurtful ones, because for me, that shows our humanity, you know. So can you say a little bit, I hope I'm not taking up too much more of your time.
No, of course. I enjoy speaking with you. This could be like a 5-hour conversation. So you know, I think some of my experience of working with elders, you know, with Dr. Vincent Harding, who was a speechwriter for Dr. King and a dear beloved friend of Dr. King's. He wrote this speech, Beyond Vietnam. He was a speechwriter for Dr. King in that speech that reportedly was the one that got Dr. King assassinated. So he was dear friends with him. So I got to work with Dr. Harding for several years in beloved community with other elders like Dr. Grace Lee Boggs. And the way that I experienced these elders was just, for me, in itself, a transformative experience, because similar to what you were saying, I just am so moved by what you said about how you experience me, because I want to be them when I grow up. And so it's really, I mean, they were these elders who basically did not feel that the hierarchy wasn't there. These are living history, on some level, living history legends to me, the work that they did around civil rights and to continue to do. But the way they showed up was, it wasn't beyond them just to sit on the floor and talk with some young people, or, you know, Dr. Harding to call me. You know, he would call me and say, you know, Brother John, I was thinking about you. And, you know, you asked me this question like 2 months ago, and I've been thinking about this question. And he would give me an answer. And I said, my response to him would be, weren't you just with the Dalai Lama like 2 days ago? Why are you calling me? And he's like, no, but listen to me. And he would just really, so there was this, there was no performative stuff. It was all about relationship and community. And so I feel really lucky that I did not experience bureaucracy with these elders. I felt like they loved me. They loved the communities they were with. And so I have internalized that since both of these, Dr. Boggs and Dr. Harding, both have transitioned. And it's time for us to step up, you know, in some ways. And so I'm really working to embody that. So the work I do, I think, is to really be in community and practice. Again, practice how to be more human beings around beloved community. You know, one of an example from when I worked with, when I worked with the young people and with the some of the elder folks in Lakewood recently, but we would explore words. I'd say, you know, for example, the prompt would be, tell me, how do you know when beloved community is not happening? Like, what are some of the indicators of it not happening? Because sometimes that's more interesting than, oh, let's talk about how beloved community could be. But I'd say, you know, what does it mean? And so I'd ask them to talk to one another about it. And then I would ask for words, like, give me some words that highlight that, right? And so when I was working with the teenagers, you know, one of the words that came up was shame. One of the students, a Black male student, said shame. And I said, can you say a little bit more about that? He's like, yeah, well, like, you know, shame on you that you're being racist. Like, he was like, he said, it's really shame on you. He was just really like, people shouldn't be like that. So I feel like they should be ashamed of themselves. And I said, oh, that's so interesting, because I have a different understanding of shame. And for me, shame is more toxic. Like, it feels more like, you know, it's almost like something that was passed down that's not mine. And then I have to do something with it. And he was like, oh, that's interesting. No, I mean, just so we were exploring that. And then I was going to go to the next word. And this other young Black woman said, can you say more about that? John, can you say more about the difference between shame and guilt for you? And I was like, this is such a beautiful. So they wanted to have a conversation. So I said, for shame for me is like, so maybe my parents went through something really horrible and they're traumatized, right, on some level. And my parents did have some horrible experiences. So their traumatic kind of behaviors I pick up on as a child, but I didn't have the same experience. Mm. And so I'm taking on their shame that's not mine. And so my work is to heal that and understand what's mine and what's theirs and support them, but also understand who I am. I said, guilt for me is like, if I do something wrong, if I hurt somebody or I say something that's really, you know, shitty or bad, I kind of should feel bad about that because I've caused some unnecessary harm. So guilt for me is like it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. I feel a little guilty that I did that and I probably should. To me, it translates like I need to be accountable and actually do something to change that, right? And so I felt like I was kind of rambling. And I said, does that make sense? She's like, this is amazing. She said, this is a great conversation. So they were really just engaged like with these words. And I think that, you know, the trainings are set up to slow us down, these beloved community workshops, to slow us down and actually examine these words, because we're all saying these words and we're assuming we know what each other means, but we don't. And we don't understand our relationship to these words. But that conversation, I think that they appreciated us, me telling my own kind of personal experience, but it gave them a chance to reflect and talk to one another about that. So I feel like we're going so fast. We're in this instant gratification. You know, you hit a link and it opens and you see it and you buy something within 3 seconds. And it's a strategy to disrupt that nonsense and to really slow things down. So we're actually in relationship and not just talking about it. You know, show me, don't tell me, you know.
I absolutely love that. That's actually that is my WhatsApp status. Show me, don't tell me.
I love it. There you go. Kindred spiritus, right?
Because, you know, and I think it also speaks to just the disappointment that many of us, I mean, my mother died when I was 17. So the disappointment of adults not showing up how they say they are, you know, like, and I think many young people have felt this. You know, and maybe for me it was also just heightened by the fact that you know, I lost my mother, but I think generally many younger people feel this disconnect between who people say they are and how they actually are. And again, the much longer conversation.
Yeah, but I do. Yeah, I just, yeah, this has been such a heartfelt, you know, for me, conversation, but also I think just about, again, about young people, it continues to feel like a gift to me that they are, you know, at the end of that session, the 4-hour session, I said, do you all want more of this? I mean, I don't know. Do you want to? Yeah, we want it. And they were so excited. And I was, and sometimes it's a mystery. It feels like a mystery why, you know, why we're in relationship and what's connecting. But I don't care anymore. I'm just grateful that it's happening. I know part of it is we don't have, you know, we don't have biological kids. We decided, my wife and I decided not to do that. We were in our 40s. We were both in school, you know, looking at our PhDs, and that was our baby, and that was it. And so I think that I do give a lot to them. I really do give a lot as far as my energy, my time, my attention, because I can, you know, I mean, it's just something that it's a gift. And so when they asked for more, you know, we have a goddaughter who's 13, you know, teenager. And if I text her and she texts back, I'm so excited. I'm just so happy that she texts back, because she doesn't have to, you know what I mean? I don't know what's, but she still wants to engage. She still wants to hang out. She still is goofy with me. And I'm just so happy, because I think as adults, we've failed a bit with being in connection with our, you know, a bit. I'm being kind, but I think we've failed. They know that we have left the building. And the thing that drives me crazy is when adults say things like to students, when they say, you're the future. And I'm like, and the kids are like, are you going to be with us? Like, are you just handing the world to us without helping us? Don't tell me I'm the future. You're still here. We're all the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the, you know, I think that's the continued work of, we're still in this together, you know, yeah. And then we can tell them that, but they have to feel it.
And
as adults, we want the same thing as adults. We want the same kind of connections, and we're struggling with that as well. Sorry, you were going to say something.
With the helping, you know, like, I think a lot of the time, you know, it's often misunderstood as material things, but like you're talking about, you know, unpacking the words, you know, like guilt, like helping people understand themselves is so much more important, because it helps people to navigate their emotions, to not feel like they need to subject themselves to social pressure, you know? And these are the things, I think, also because of just how economically Black families in particular were structured or affected by economic injustice, right? Where it is the Black families, the Black parents, whether it's women or men, that have often had to work very long hours, right? Meaning parents were not able, even migrant workers, right? Economic immigrants, not being there to guide their children, to play those roles of mother or father. You know, I made an example with my own experience speaking to someone where I had to forgive my own father for not having been present, because I understood that his own father was not present in his life, right? So beginning to shift how we also see each other as Black people, and to see the systemic cause of our realities, and choosing the hard work, the beloved community work to change, to transform our communities, right? Because the system has got us at a particular place that ensures that our families and our communities continue to disintegrate. Right. Black people now are some of the highest. I was listening to someone making a comment on the internet saying, now Black women have become the highest paid alcohol brand influencers.
I guess we've arrived. I don't know what that means. Yeah, I mean, this is the, what is success, right? What does that look like? Is it really our success? But I think, you know, one of the talking about the heart work, I always say that, you know, it's heart work and it's hard work, you know, it's heart and it's hard. It's both of those things. It's difficult. And it's also such an important piece. And maybe that's the next conversation is like, really, how are we integrating our hearts into this, you know, into this work? Because I think, you know, I do think systemically, you know, especially with, you know, when I think about communities of color, Black communities, yeah, those systems are pushing in and telling us you have to make a choice between your heart and your body. And basically, or actually maybe not even paying attention to either of those, right? And your spirit, we're making a deal with this kind of devil of a system, you know, to actually lose ourselves. And so the recovery work is, how do we come back from that? And I think that we can. I know that I'm continuing to come back. I think the choice of not having children for me was a difficult one because I love kids. But it has been such a beautiful, I had some insecurity about that choice, but I just have been so grateful about how many kids I've unofficially just adopted, you know, and also the kid in me that got to be paid attention to and got to heal, you know. So that's the ongoing work. And I would love another or several, like, probably conversations with you about these things.
Yes. Almost 90 minutes. This should probably stop with that.
Yes, to be continued, to be continued. Stay tuned, audience. Stay tuned.
But any closing remarks from you, Dr. John Scott?
Thank you so much, Mabato, for inviting me to be here. I'm honored to be in community with you and in conversation with you. And I know that you are, even in the short time of knowing you, you're really walking your walk. And so any way I can connect you to some more good people, I'll continue to do that. Even in this conversation, I'm thinking about two or three people that I'll talk to you about later that I want you to connect with, because we have to start. The remembering is really tightening that web that's always been there, but we've kind of, it's gotten loose a little bit. And so I want us to reconnect with one another, so we're not feeling isolated and you're not feeling isolated in this work.
Thank you so much. And I look forward to continuing to be in beloved community with you. You know, I feel so honored to be in such close proximity, firstly, and this is not a totalizing thing, with someone who has worked so closely with the work and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King. He's someone who, he's one of my ancestors, like, literally. And so it gives me great joy to see how the ancestors are working, you know, because for me, that is a validation as well. But also just for your kindness and your open-heartedness, and for the support you continue to give me. So I look forward to, you know, growing the community and being in more conscious conversations, so that we can begin to, you know, or rather continue and accelerate the work of healing, you know, by raising the consciousness of our communities. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. And you said it, but our ancestors do not play around. So they are actively connecting us. So keep paying attention.
Thank you for journeying with us in this episode of Conscious Conversations. May something spoken here return to you when you most need it, gently, powerfully, as a reminder of your wholeness. If this conversation moved you, I'd love to hear from you. You can connect with us through montsiem.com. Until next time, stay present, stay tender, and remember, you are not alone in the work of transformation and liberation. Now.